Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I hope everybody's paying attention today because we have a friend calling in from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and his name is Ronald Olivier, and he has a book out about redemption, and we're going to talk to him about his life and his experiences in the Angola prison in Louisiana. So welcome to the show, Ronald. How are you doing today?
Oh, great. Thank you, man. Thank you for having me.
So yeah, I mean, when you dive into this, I'm a firm believer of good people can make decisions that affect their life. It takes them in the wrong direction, you know, and you just don't know till you know, and you don't think about those decisions a lot of time. So tell me a little bit about your lifestyle and what got you put in the Angola prison in Louisiana.
I'm a native of New Orleans, Louisiana. I grew up in a very poverty-stricken area. I can remember my mother moved from the 7th ward, from that 7th ward to the 8th ward. New Orleans is separated into different wards, if you would. And I can remember when she moved, it was a real nice neighborhood. I can remember on the porch feeding the birds. But something happened about in the late 80s. There was a big transition in the neighborhood. It was the crack epidemic, and it came and literally destroyed our neighborhood. And so with it came a lot of violence. I can remember when that took place, the birds wouldn't even show up there anymore. And around the same transition that was taking place prior to it, my father, who I stayed with on weekends and summers and some holidays, had a real great relationship with my father. Father was like everything to me. And during this period of time, he had left. He left and moved to Jacksonville, Florida. And my little 15, 16-year-old mind couldn't grasp that. And I was very hurt. I felt abandoned. And so consequently, I turned to the streets and what was happening around me. And the streets began to follow me. I began to learn the street game and run with absolutely wrong crowd. But they became my heroes. That's who I looked up to. That's who I wanted to be. Drug dealer. I was robbing people. I was stealing cars, all type of negativity, and it surrounded me. My neighborhood was very violent. It was common to hear gunshots and see people with gunshot wounds or see people dead in the street. That was very common. And to hear police sirens day and night, very common in my neighborhood. So that became normal to me. So the abnormal became normal to me, and I got really just accustomed to that. You know, I thought, really, that's how it was supposed to be. And I can remember later, my dad sent for me probably about 5-6 months later in Jacksonville. And man, it was so quiet that it disturbed me. You know, I didn't hear gunshots, didn't hear sirens, and I thought something was wrong. And so the normal was abnormal to me. And so I ended up going back to New Orleans, what I was accustomed to. And consequently, I found myself in an altercation with a guy. We had jumped him, and the next time we saw him was Christmas Day, and I was outnumbered, and he was with about 6 other guys, and man, shots rang out, and man, 2 people ended up in a pool of blood. 1 died and 1 survived, and it was by my hand. I had pulled the trigger. And so this was at the age of 16. So I found myself in a juvenile facility first. I can remember I thought like other times I had been in trouble that my mother come sign me out. You know, I had been into the juvenile bureau for things like assault, simple robbery, theft. And I called my mother. She'd come down and she'd sign me out, or we'd get some adult to come sign me out. And I thought that was going to happen this time. But Mama couldn't sign me out right there. So I found myself, man, end up facing the death penalty because the juvenile courts transferred me to the adult courts, and they charged me with first-degree murder. And there my journey begins in this unbeknown world that I wasn't accustomed to.
So when you hear these stories a lot, you know, young people pulling that trigger. I mean, what was that like after you pulled the trigger? Not taking out account, someone died, someone survived, just taking that out of account. How did you feel after that?
Afterwards, I guess I was like in some type of zone. And then like afterwards, I snapped out and realized where I was. And there was a police station like two blocks away. So my mind is thinking, man, I got to get away. I got to get away. And I never forget, because I had guys try to pull me off the front of the bus. I was on the first step of the bus, and I turned around shooting and shot them and walked on the, I had my money in one hand and a gun still in the other hand, and I walked to the back of the bus and sat down. And then when I realized what was going on and where I was, I began to hit the emergency window to jump out the window and just run. And I never forget a guy on the front of the bus said, man, don't run. He said, the bus driver going to continue his route, man. Those guys were trying to rob you. They're trying to snatch you off the bus. And sure enough, the bus driver continued his route. And when he turned the corner, at that corner, there were two people. Everybody looked up and saw there was two people in the pool of blood. He continued his route. And all I'm thinking about now at that time is getting away. I got to get away. I got to get away. And I think later, probably that night, I remember like yesterday, I had ended up by a cousin's house. And I'm looking in the mirror. And I'm like, I never forget, I asked myself this question in the mirror. I said, who are you? What have you done? What have you become? And I started crying. And then I started laughing. Then I was crying and laughing. So it was almost like a hysterical moment that was going on with me, you know, after that.
Because the feelings, when you think about feelings and you being, you said 16 years old, you're coming out of it. But a lot of people don't realize that their subconscious is being programmed, you know, from the time they're born through their teens. And at a certain point, when you get a certain age, that, you know, that programming kind of ceases. And then you start, you know, you start responding to things innately with your unconscious bias based on your experiences. So a lot of people don't realize that. And when you, you know, and you think you're, I guess, how do I put this, is you're living your life in this lane, right? And then until something, you have a traumatic experience, that's when a lot of people don't know what to do, you know, when they have this traumatic experience, because they're so young, they're still going through this programming process as a human being.
Right.
So it makes it very complex that I don't think is looked at. And I also had this realization yesterday when we were talking about organizations or whatever it is, whether it's government, maybe a religious organization, maybe it's a community. And I think a lot of times people are put into situations. If you're thinking about rules, let's say you have to follow rules, and those rules get more intense because they want to control the situation, whatever entity it is, whether it's a community, whatever. Same thing, you know, in the community, if you're paying attention to survive and
right.
You're forgetting in those situations, you forget about yourself. You don't relish any value for yourself or create any value for yourself. So when you run out of that landscape in that room, you look for these feelings of what makes me feel good here, 5 minutes. What makes me feel good here, 5 minutes. And it may not be good. It may be on the dark side, but a lot of people don't realize that. Have you ever thought about that kind of scenario, about how, you know, situations can move people a certain direction?
Yes, definitely. I think any kid, wherever they grow up at, you know, their greatest teacher is not what they hear as opposed to what they see. And so I'm being taught a lot of things in the streets and that dark side, which you're talking about, and how to survive, and being really programmed to think that I have to do this to survive. I have to carry a gun all the time. I have to be tough. I can't be the prey. I have to be the one who prey upon someone else. And so it puts you in that mindset and puts you like subconsciously what you're talking about, you know, and really train you in how to respond, so to speak. And so I found myself in that situation there.
And how did family respond?
Family, totally different, you know. And so I was a totally different person at home, to where after I committed this crime, they couldn't even believe that I'd done it. And so a totally different person in the street. And so didn't have a family where family goes to prison or anything. My family didn't do things like that. And so here I am. They were, I think my mother for a while, her response was that I was way in Florida with my dad. You know, she was embarrassed, you know, to even let anybody know that I was locked up. my sister, my siblings was very sad that I was gone. And so it just created this ripple effect of hurt and pain on both sides, on my side, on with the family, and even the victim side, and all that the victim family went through.
So when you were tried as an adult, you got sentenced. When you first had to go to Angola prison, what was that like? How old were you?
I was about 18, but backing up at the trial, there was a pivotal moment that happened to me at the trial.
Okay.
While I'm on trial, I'm 17 years old now. I'm facing the death penalty. And so up until this moment, everything was really like a joke to me. I was very optimistic, man. I'm going home. I won't be here long. You know, this gonna pass. I'll be back on the streets again. And, you know, and so while the jury was deliberating and they brought me in a holding tank all alone by myself, three concrete walls in the cell, I could still hear the cell slamming and he locking it, the guard locking it and leaving me there alone. And that's where everything got real, because I was facing the death penalty at that time. And I began to think, man, 12 people who don't know anything about me is about to make a decision whether I live or die. I was like, man, I don't want to die. In that moment, man, I could hear my mother's voice. My mother was a real praying woman, real godly woman. Always went to church and always prayed for me. And I can hear her voice saying, she said, baby, if you ever in trouble that I can't get you out, and you make sure you call on the name of Jesus. And man, I just did that. I heard that. I did that. I cried out to God. I got on my knees and I said this prayer. You know, I made a deal with God. Some people say you don't make a deal with God, but I made a deal. And I said, Lord, I said, if you don't let these people kill me, I'll serve you the rest of my life. And for the first time in my life, I experienced the peace of God. I was just calm. There was an assurance in me that I was going to be all right. So I go out and the jury comes back with a guilty verdict of the lesser offense, which is the responsive verdict. Second degree murder. Now, second degree murder carried a mandatory life sentence without benefits of parole or probation. In layman's terms, that means I die in prison. I never get out. And so while I'm sitting there receiving that sentence, I didn't know the consequence of that. You know, I didn't know it carried a life sentence. But meanwhile, I like to tell a story like this, man. During that moment in that holding tank, man, I got two life sentences, one from the state and I believe the other one from God. He gave me a life sentence because my life changed from that moment. Mm-hmm. And so as I went about, you know, going through Angola, I still looked the same, act the same, talk the same. But the difference was, and I believe, and I count that to what happened to me in the cell, is that, man, I felt bad about talking how I talk or doing the things that I did. You know, that was just conviction that set up on me. And, man, I just wasn't comfortable with it. And so very uncomfortable in a life I was living. Now, things that didn't matter, you know, before now matter. And so here I am on my way. I'll never forget, on the bus, going down this 20-mile-long snake road to Angola. And I'm thinking about all the stories I heard about Angola. Angola was once labeled the bloodiest prison in the nation. They got that name for the violence and the blood that was spilled there. Someone was always getting stabbed up and killed there, and even raped. And so they preyed upon young men. I'm 18 years old, didn't have a string of hair in my face. I was 5'11", 131 pounds, looked like I was about 12 years old. And so here I am, and I'm like, man, I made a decision on that bus that, man, I'm going in this place a man, and I'm coming out a man, whether I'm coming out walking or I'm coming out in a box dead. I'm going to protect my manhood at all times. So that was my mindset. But amazingly, man, I believe God was orchestrating this whole plan with my life. And he placed me around people that was willing to help me and not hurt me. Man, some of the greatest men of God I've met was in prison, you know, and these was pastors and my mentors and, man, guys who was guiding me the right way to get in school, to get a GED, and all these positive programs that they had, and just pushing me to become a better person. And man, I believe God blessed me with that. Just sent me around the right people, man. And man, my life began to change. They began to mentor me and taught me how important it was to read my Bible, of studying, of going to church and really developing a prayer life. And man, as I did that, man, a lot of things began to change. My mind began to be renewed. And I started to see life from a different perspective. And that launched me into the Bible College. There was a Bible College there, Baptist Theological Seminary, an extension center established there where there was professors that came from the outside and did their lectures and exams or what have you, like any other college. And we had our actual graduation, you know, with caps and gowns, and where we could invite family to the graduation. All the faculty comes, the president, and they have this ceremony. And after 4 years, I had graduated with a bachelor's degree in Christian ministry. And so I found myself after that, you're an inmate minister, so you're allowed to minister, and they'll give you a certain area, and that's your job, to be an inmate minister, just assist people with their religious belief or what have you. And man, I did that. And then soon, you know, as the Bible College continued to grow and ministers begin to stack up on each other, ministers was in every area of the prison and completely changed the outcome and how, you know, violent it was. You know, there, you know, you only hear something now here, you know, very seldom you'll hear even of a fight, you know, a simple fight. You know, it was completely changing the culture of the prison. And as they grew and they continued to stack up on each other, the warden then, Warden Burrow Kane, come up with an idea, what I believe was a God idea, to send out missionaries. And so after you graduate, you had the opportunity to go to another prison in Louisiana and assist the chaplain and also pastor a church. And so I went to another prison and assist the chaplain and pastor a church, which launched me into and pushed me into this area of leadership that really changed my life. And had a great time there, did a lot of great positive things there that impact some people's lives. I can remember there, one of the things I done without a credit to probably me coming home was start a prayer meeting. Put out a flyer concerning a prayer meeting. If you've been barred out of court or you can't get back in court, and you looking to go home, man, bring all your paper and legal work to the altar. I believe there's a judge greater than the judge. Mm-hmm. And we brought it before God and just prayed. And man, so many guys went home.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, we rejoiced. And later my turn came and I ended up back in Angola after about 3.5 years on a missionary journey. I ended up back there and amazingly, the law changed in 2012. The United States Supreme Court came down with a ruling in Miller versus Alabama that said it was unconstitutional to give a juvenile a mandatory life sentence. Said it violated our constitutional rights of the Eighth Amendment, which is cruel and unusual punishment. It said a juvenile should have some type of meaningful opportunity for freedom, and it broke down the parts of the brain in the juvenile that's not even developed, the frontal lobe, and that part of the brain that helps you appreciate risk and consequences. And it talked about how we shouldn't be treated as adults in that manner. And when it came down with that ruling in 2012, that deemed my sentence illegal. And so I went back to court on a motion to correct the legal sentence. And man, got re-sentenced. Amazingly, during this time when I go to court, I remember my lawyers kind of nervously coming telling me, man, there's someone here, man. The victim's sister showed up, so you might have some victim opposition. And we know that victim opposition carried a lot of weight. You know, a lot of times that depended on whether you would be released or not, or get some type of relief or not. Mm-hmm. Man, I can remember when I first came in the courtroom, the lady on the front row was just staring at me. She was just staring. I looked at her, I didn't want to step back and make her feel uncomfortable. I'm looking already scared because I'm handcuffed and shackled in an orange jumpsuit. So I kept looking away and just checking and looking out my peripheral just to see. And she just was staring. And when he came and told me, I was like, no, that's not his sister. That's his mother. Because I remembered her face out of everybody in the courtroom. I can't even really remember the face of my lawyer. But I remember the face of the mother, this mother who was on the stand crying because I had taken her son away. And when I had that experience in that holding tank and later got a prayer life, man, I prayed for her. So I prayed for her more than I prayed for anybody. And I always had the desire to one day to have a conversation with her, just a dialogue with her, and just tell her how remorseful I was, how sorry I was, and hoping that she forgive me. And so I saw that opportunity in court when he come to him. I said, man, I said, get with the DA and find out if I can talk to her. So he went over there, got with the DA. DA talked to her, come back, said, look, she said she don't want to talk. What she's going to say, she's going to say it on the stand. And behold, my court date was set back to the following month, and which gave me some time to pray. And just keep her lifted up. And behold, when I came back, she offered that I talk to her. And we had this dialogue. I was handcuffed and shackled, and she's behind me, and I had to turn around. And I'll never forget when I turned around and looked up in her eyes. Just the most difficult, hardest conversation I have ever had with a human being. When I turned around to look at her, her arms was folded. And she was just staring at me. And I broke the silence. I said, ma'am, I said, I take full responsibility for the death of your son. And when I said that, she took a deep breath and she exhaled. And her arms relaxed and she leaned toward me. And I said, ma'am, I said, I have no excuses. I said, it was senseless, very idiotic of me, a very bad decision I made. I said, all I can ask is that you find somewhere in your heart to forgive me. She said, man, she said, I don't hate you. And she said, I forgive you. And I believe you deserve a second chance. Now, while we having this dialogue, there's no dry eye. Both of us are crying. It's very emotional. And she began to talk to me. She said, what I didn't know was when my son had passed away, that he had a son. And she said, I took him and raised him. And she said, man, he forgives you. She said, I wanted him to come today and meet you today, you know. And I told her, I said, ma'am, I said, I'd love to meet him. I said, if I get out, I said, I'd love to meet him. And she said this here. She said, not if you get out, when you get out. And so very awesome moment there, very emotional moment. But when she said she forgave me, man, it was like the shackles and the handcuffs that were on me came off. It didn't even matter to me how the proceedings of the court went after that, because this was the pinnacle. This was greater. My greatest desire was to meet her and have that conversation with her, that she hopefully forgive me. You know, that was greater than me going home. And she got up later on the stand and echoed what she said in private on the record. And I got re-sentenced, you know, everybody clapped. It was an awesome time there. And I later went up for parole in 2018 of November and made parole and was discharged November the 30th of 2018. I walked up out of the gates of Angola after serving 27 summers.
27 years. So that would have made you how old?
43.
43. When you think about your connection to God, and what's your lineage of the family? Like grandmothers, mom and dad, grandmothers, you know, down the line, was there any type of connection to spirituality or in that kind of?
Oh, yes. Grandparents, I know for sure. I even had an opportunity to meet my, on my dad's side, my great grandmother, who died at the age of 93, met her. Very spiritual woman. Met her sister, who died at 104. And so my family on both my dad and my mom's side was very connected to God, man. And that's what helped me have that type of awareness, you know. Even though I wasn't serious about it or didn't really have a real relationship with God, because in my household, whether my dad's house or my mom's house, you didn't have a choice. You was going to church on Sunday. You didn't, mm-hmm. It wasn't optional. Church wasn't optional and school wasn't optional. And so whether I was by my dad's house, we was going to church, or whether I was by my mom's house, we was going to church.
Because there's a lot of spirituality, obviously, in Louisiana area. I mean, because I think it's where a lot of the families and they came from. They came from a spiritual place. I think there's a lot to that connection. I almost think it's like a grid, you know, in that lineage and that bloodline, you know, that's passed down and passed down. It's this word that came into play, and you were able to utilize that, you know, for yourself to change your life.
Yes.
What did you do first when you got out?
One of the first things I'd done I had a great desire to do was take a bath. I had taken a shower for 27 years, just wanted to sit in the tub,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so that was very interesting. But I first began to work. I came home into a job, a mayor of a town, also a pastor. He was the chaplain when I went on a missionary journey, who I got connected with. He gave me a job. I was working for the town of Simsport, and he put me on staff at his church as a youth minister. And man, my life just began to take off from that. He gave me a place to stay. Had a little modular home, 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, a living room, nice big living room, nice big kitchen, you know. And it was great because I really wanted to live on my own, because I didn't know how that felt. I never experienced that. You know, when I went to prison, I was living with my mother.
Yeah.
So I didn't even know how it looked to pay a bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so, man, just wanted that experience for myself. And I had a girlfriend at the time, and she had a home, but I didn't want to live with someone just coming home and not married to him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're married. We'll be married in April, about 5 years. November the 30th, it'll make 5 years that I've been home. And we have a little son together. I got a 3-year-old little son. He'll be 4 in January. And, man, one of the greatest blessings, man, and I could ever have is just watching him grow old and being a part of his life. And so I went from there, made a transition from Simsport working on the warden, who was the former warden of Angola, Burl Kane. He called me. He had now was in Mississippi, and the commissioner over the departments of correction. So he's over all the prisons. So he calls me to be the director of chaplaincy, the head chaplain in Mississippi State Penitentiary. And I went, took my family there, man, did some great things there. And just recently made the transition from there. I think I stayed there, 2.5 years, made the transition from there to Baton Rouge in April. And now I work for the Louisiana Parole Project. It was the same project that when I discharged from home, I went through it, their program. They help men who have done long periods of time, over 2 decades. They help them to make a transition into society, complete wraparound service. They help them with housing, with clothing, getting a job, with food. And then there's classes they take on to help them get acclimated. Things like technology, because guys, done over 20 years, they don't know anything about a cell phone,
mm-hmm.
you know, things like that, and credit cards, and, you know, how to make the transition from just using cash to cards now, and self-checkout, this whole thing. They bring you through this process and help you re-enter society. And, man, that was a blessing to me. And when I came back this week, They hired me as a client advocate. And so I help guys make a transition from prison now with my experience and also help them get jobs.
Nice. Do they ever talk about anything? You know, you talk about that programming. And I talk to a lot of neuroscientists, and they say you can reset your mind in 9 weeks, but you have to have somewhat of an overhaul of positivity. Do they, you know, because like every day I get up and I say certain things over and over and over. Do they talk about the power of the mind and telling yourself you are confident or you are good or whatever it is that can build you up? And they talk about
that. Exactly. And that's some biblical principles there. Mm-hmm. You know, the Bible speaks about that a lot, about the power of words. Death and life is in the power of the tongue. And how important it is for not only that other people, you be around other people that speak in positive, but that you say some positive acclamations over yourself, you know, and have this positive outlook on yourself and say it and hear yourself saying it, you know, very important. And especially because they stay with us at least a month. You know, they go past a month if we see that they need more, some more time with us. It depends on the person and how well they are coming along, and they'll go to their final destination where they're gone. And it's important because we check out where they're going. You know, what type of environment are you going into? Are you going back into the same environment that, you know, got you into that, you know? And so we try, if it's a situation like that, we try to redirect and help them here to start over in a new place, a new environment where no one knows you, you know? Because that's very important, you know, because you get around the same people doing the same thing, you'll end up doing them on them. The Bible talks about that. It says evil communication will corrupt a good spirit. You know, you can be real good, just hang around the wrong thing too long, and you become it. And so that's very important part of our program.
Interesting. Well, I mean, the thing is really the difference between the light and the dark is just a thought process.
Yes.
You know, and whichever way you perpetuate that process, it can become stronger, it can become weaker, whatever it is. But I think, too, to your point, is good you look to find where these people go, because if you've been there and you've established a barometer, you've established an impression, and even though you may have of not thinking about those thoughts anymore, if you get around that again, it can send you right back to that impression.
So easy.
Yeah.
And our program was established like the Louisiana Parole Project was established in 2016. We've had over 480 clients, probably about 500 right now. And it's been reported that we have a less than 2% recidivism rate. And so that translates to saying that people that comes through our program is more than likely not to go back to prison. They become successful citizens. They hardworking, tax-paying citizens, and impact their community wherever they go.
You know, I don't know if this has ever been done too, and I think if our government and people in that make these decisions can understand the mindset and maybe try to eliminate some of these narratives that they put around someone who's coming out.
Yes, man, that's exactly. And so that's what we're trying to do. And we have had a lot of success with the political realm and seeing our success. And so they have become comfortable with letting people go on parole, especially if any of our attorneys may represent them, and they know that they're coming through our program, you know. And some people, they go on there and go for parole, and the parole board will recommend that they have parole only if they come through our program. They see the success of it. And man, that's pivotal, man, in changing that narrative and that labeling, you know, because it defeats the purpose. You know, it puts the person right back on the track. Are doing the same thing. You know, if they can't get a job, if they're denied opportunity or employment because they're an ex-offender, you know, they're going to do what they know to do to get money, you know, what they used to do. Yeah. That'll run them right back into that circle.
Yeah, we're gonna spend all this money to make you better, but we're going to remind you who you are so you don't forget and stay in that lane, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Very hypocritical.
Yeah, it's counterintuitive. It's like, what's going on here? I don't know. Right. Those are things I think about, you know, and think about people. And, you know, I just think we just need to look at how people are affected by things differently and quit trying to put people in categories based on who they are, what they are, and so forth, because that doesn't make any sense either at the end of the day.
No.
Well, I think it's a big redemption story. You thought about pitching the book as a movie?
Yes, sir. Definitely have. And got some offers already. You know, it's picking up some traction. So not only as a movie, as a series.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I think sooner or later it's going to come. I thought about that before I wrote the book.
Yeah.
You know, that it's going to eventually become a movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Because it's hard to find real life redemption story.
Right.
You know, and I think that's a big deal and can be a put out a good impression where other people can learn from your process.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, definitely.
And if we want to find the book, where can we find the book?
It's on Amazon. You can order it on Amazon. It's in hardback, and also it's on audio. You can order it there.
Gotcha. And the book is, just reminded me, 27 Summers, My Journey to Freedom, Forgiveness, Redemption During My Time in Angola Prison. So I think it's a great story, redemption. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, if I'm in Baton Rouge, I'll look you up. And this has been Ronald Olivier, and I am John Edmonds Cosma, the CEO of Bang Productions. Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.